So we are holding on Chamachamu Beis, about halfway down the widest line, the line against Loimaloch. Okay, since we were discussing yesterday, started discussing the whole matter of the Avos Nezikin, the Av Nezikin of Eish, and in the course of it, we discussed briefly the matter of Tamun, if something is hidden, whether you are on Chayav for it. And now Gemara is going to bring in another piece of Agata that relates to that topic. In two places in Tanakh, in Sefer Shmuel and also in Divrei Yamim, the pasuk gives us a list of David's Giborim, the top officers in his army, and it mentions for a couple of them, it mentions various exploits that they did, various heroic things they did. There's a story there that in both places that goes like this, with minor variations, some of which we'll deal with the variations in the Gemara. At one point, David is fighting against the Plishtim. The Plishtim are camped out in Beis Lechem. And David says, "Mi yashkeni mayim mi bor Beis Lechem." Halavai, somebody would give me water to drink from the well of Beis Lechem that's by the gate. So three of these Giborim break through the Plishti line. They go to Beis Lechem. They draw water. They bring it back to David. David says, I can't drink this. Hayitachen, I'm going to drink water that was brought at risk to people's lives. And he poured it out as a nisuch hamayim to the Eish. So what's going on over there? So Mephoshim, on a chat level, Mephoshim talk about what's going on is not literally when he was saying, halavai, somebody would bring me water, he didn't literally mean he wants somebody to go and risk their lives to bring him water. Why does he need water from there as opposed to just getting water locally? He just meant, you know, like he reminisced about old times. You know, I remember that good water they had in Beis Lechem when I was growing up, halavai. I wish I could have some of it again. And they wanted to give him nachas ruach. They loved him as men. So some of them kind of took it on themselves to go and get it. And when they come back, completely not expecting it, he says, you know, something like that that was done at such risk to people's lives, you can't stop and drink it like it was regular water. It has to be, if people risk their lives for it, it has to be for something great. And not really like hectish, but whatever. The Abarbanel on the pulpit gives an analogy, which is, I think he says, ultimately, I think he says, comes from Mer Nebuchim, like you wouldn't spend millions of dollars to build a factory to make one needle. So if people have risked their lives to bring this water, it's not right that it should just be drunk stamas. I should use it to serve the image to it.
Why specifically
on a path level, he was saying, you know, I grew up in Beis Lechem. I remember the good water over there. And he was born in Beis Lechem. Yeah, he was born and grew up there until he was 28. Yeah, 26, whatever.
And the Plishtim
right now, we can't say it. Okay, so that's all on a chat level. The Gemara is taking it in a different way, though, for one thing, because of the difficulty that Taka, why would he even be thinking of water from there when he knows it's an enemy territory? Actually, Marshall points out in Madur Batra another detail as well from the Pesukim that suggests we're not talking Stam about water. He uses the expression miyashkein, which literally means halavai, somebody would give me to drink. You don't give somebody to drink water. What does he expect somebody to pour down his throat? So therefore, the Gemara has to assume that it means something else. Ein mayim ela Torah. Water is a metaphor for Torah. So therefore, it means that he wants, and especially the part you're mentioning, Asher Bashar, that this well is by the gate. The gate is a famous thing throughout Tanakh. That's usually where the local Sanhedrin, where the local base in sat. Therefore, the Gemara is going to assume that it means that he wanted a psak in halacha from the base in that sat by the gate to base lechem.
What?
That's what we're going to learn. So the pasuk says, "Va'yisav David va'yomer," that David had a craving, and he said, "Mi yashkeni mayim mi'bor Beis Lechem asher bashar," who will give me to drink water from the well of Beis Lechem that's by the gate? "Va'yivku shloshes giborim machnit plishtim," so the three giborim, the three of David's top soldiers, broke through the camp of the plishtim. "Va'yishav mayim mi'bor Beis Lechem asher bashar," they drew water from this well of Beis Lechem that's by the gate and brought it to David. So what was David looking for? Again, the Gemara is not assuming that he's found looking for water. It means that he had a shaila in halach. What was the shaila? Amar Rava, Amar Rav Nachman, tamun ba'esh kamaboyalai. His question was about this matter of tamun in fire. Namely, Rashi says, during the course of the war, his men had burnt a stack of grain that belonged to some Jews. Now, in that stack of grain, there were things hidden inside it. So the question was, is he hired to pay just as we'll learn in the next, as we'll learn later on some halachon days, the question, machlokes Rabbi Yehuda and Chachamim, are you actually obligated to pay for the things that were hidden inside there, or are you just hired to pay as if that space was just taken up with whatever? Somebody is, that's what Rashi learns, that David soldiers had destroyed it in the course of the war. So now, in other words, belonging to Jews, belonging to the Christian, they wouldn't be asking.
Right,
but you could have, let's say, a stack of grain like that might be worth, let's say, $100, but inside the stack of grain, there were actually, not all of it was grain. Inside there were hidden kalim, which the kalim might be worth $500. So the question is, what do you have to pay? According to the Chachamim, as we will learn later, all you have to do is you have to imagine as though the entire volume of the stack was just made up of grain. So fine, a stack of grain this size would be worth 100. That's all you have to pay. Whereas according to the Yehuda, you're going to be obligated to pay for $80 for the grain, let's say, and $500 for the kalim. So that's two different ways of looking at it. They may have been tebeim, and it's a different approach to talk about the possibility. That's what we're going to talk about later, but wait. Marshall, by the way, has a different interesting explanation. He says that given that the Gemara is going to point out soon, you have two different psukim. Again, the story is so you have these psukim in Shmuel Beis and also in Divrei Yom Aleph. And in one place, as the Gemara is going to point out in a minute, it mentions a field of barley. And in the other place, it mentions a field of lentils. So Marshall learns that actually the problem with Tamun over here was that they were burning, again, they were burning fields in order to smoke out the plishtim or whatever. It happened that there was a stack of barley over there. But inside the barley, there were hidden lentils. And now as they're burning it, he discovers that. So now, it's a question of Tamun. So he was asking, Tom and Reish come by, like, Ikir Bihoda, Ikir Abanon, is the halacha like Rabbi Yehuda, that you're chayev for whatever's hidden inside there, or like the Rabbanon, that you're potter? Well, postulate, might apostulate, and they answered whatever they answered. We don't know what they answered. They may have held like Rabbi Yehuda, they may have held like the Chacham, but whatever it was, he got his answer. The Gibbotim actually broke through the plishti lines to go to the Beis Din of Beis Lechem and get a psakim on it. Rav Huna said no, it was a different. What? David, it doesn't say. The pasuk just says the David Azbam Mitzuda, that he was in the fortress. So maybe that means the fortress in Yerushalayim, maybe it means one of the fortresses. I guess not. But, no, there was other words. The Plishtim were camped in Beis Lechem, that's why they had to break through. I think there are actually Mepharshim who learn that this was before David even became king. You know, in Divrei Hayomim, it describes how the various detachments of the Gibbotim were coming and joining David even while he was still on the run from Shaul. One of them actually we mentioned in Matzah Shabbos and in Viyitmacha, we have the pasuk Ruach Lavshat Amasai Reisha Shalishim, is one of them where Amasa comes with a group, with a group of Jews to join David, and David comes out and says, where are you guys coming to be friendly to me, or are you coming to hand me over to Shaul? And Amasa speaks up, Lachal David Vim Kaban Yishai, the whole pasuk that we quote over there, and David accepts them. So you have those groups of people. So the point is, David Ozbam Suda, where it says that he was in the fortress, may even mean he was in one of these places where he's hiding out from Shaul. And that may have been part of the issue. He may not, when he's king, fine. Okay, so they burnt down one stack of grain. What, he's a king, he doesn't have enough money to pay for it. But if this happened before, while he's still on the run from Shaul, he doesn't have a lot of extra money, so therefore he needs to ask a Shaila. What? Because he was forage, he was Nimshach already by Shmuel. Right. He was already nimshach by Shmuel, but as we learned way, way back in Megillah, that Abigail told him during that one point when he was mad at Nabal for denying him and his men food, and he thinks Nabal is a murderer, Malchus, he needs to be executed. Abigail comes and tells him, yes, you are a melech because you are nimshach, but the fact is, lo yotza tivacha ba'olam, you're not yet accepted by the people as king yet because Shaul is still alive, and David conceded that she's right. So this could have been a similar kind of thing. Anyway. So, because that's how it is. There's a concept that there is such a thing that you need to be accepted by the people as well. And until in Melech Balayam, after all. We should talk a long time about it, but we have a block to cover. But I'll tell you, in Shulchan Aruch, Rambam mentioned this. It was recently in Rambam Shlosha Prakim, and also it's mentioned in Shulchan Aruch, that the key difference is a king's coinage accepted by the people. Kings mint coins with their portraits on them to show that they're legitimate. If people use his coinage, it means they accept him as a legitimate king. Otherwise, then he sounded like a bandit or a warlord or something.
Or a wrestling king.
That doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. No. Here, when Abigail tells David, Lo yotha tivacha ba'olam, one explanation of Lo yotha tivacha means your coins are not yet circulating. The people are not yet accepting you as king in that you're using coins with your inscriptions on it. Doesn't matter. You may have been anointed by the Ebeshter, but until the people, actually, you need a king needs to be appointed also by the needs to be anointed by the Sanhedrin, by permission of the Sanhedrin and a Navi. They're here, you had a Navi. Shmuel Navi did it, but the Sanhedrin wasn't yet involved. The people were, yeah. Okay. Anyway. So that's one explanation, is that there was a situation of Tamar over here. Rav Huna says a different explanation. What happened is, Dishin Yisrael, this Odom Yisrael Habu, there were piles, there were stacks of barley that belonged to Jews that were in that area, to have a metamony plishtim, but when there were plishtim hiding out in and among those stacks of barley. So therefore, so David figured, good, then we have an easy way to smoke them out. Well, we'll burn down the stacks of barley, and then the plishtim will be trapped. The common bite light. So therefore, he had a question. Are you allowed to save yourself at the expense of somebody else's mom? So Shulchulay, so they answered him, also l'haftal after mum chaveri. As a matter of fact, you are also. Now, what we mean by that also, we'll talk in a second. No, the chaveri meaning Jews. The barley belonged to Jews. The plishtim were hiding out. Yeah. But so they tell him it's also to save yourself with somebody at the expense of somebody else's mum. Aval after melech after, but you are melech. So again, maybe we're talking only de jure. Maybe we're talking also de facto, whatever it is. Yeah. Definitely de jure. He's definitely already nimshach as king. The question is whether we mean de facto. Anyway, okay. Umelach poreth lasis lederach vein mochin diyado. And the halacha is that a king can make a breach to break through to make himself a road, and nobody can object to him. And in fact, Brother Basra says there's no limit if he needs land for a road for his troops or what have you. There's no limit how wide he can make it. So therefore, yes, there's an exception to that.
Eminent domain,
kind of, yeah. So what are we talking about over here? Now, Rashi, at least at face value, Rashi seems to say, Rashi says at the end, that Rashi quotes what the Gemara says, you're also lost to last in Maman Chaveri, that you're talking not allowed to, and therefore later on, the Gemara is going to mention that the Pasuk is by Yassi Lo, he saved it, meaning he didn't allow them to burn it down, because it would have been an Isser to do that. So according to Rashi, at least at face value, it means it's actually also to do that, even in the case of Pekuach Nefesh. And there are some achronim who learn that that is what Rashi means, in fact. Even if it's a matter of the Kuach Nefesh, it is, in fact, also la'afu'afu mamas haveri. However, Tosfos says the question is not whether you're allowed to. Of course you're allowed to. It's Kuach Nefesh. The question is only, do you have to pay afterward? After la'achar ha'maisa, you saved yourself at the expense of mamas haveri. Later on, do you have to reimburse the person for it? That was the shaila.
So
according to that way of looking at it, also doesn't mean it's forbidden to do. It means that if you did it, you're going to be chayav to pay. Yeah. And then they talk about different variations on it, that maybe even according to Rashi, it doesn't mean it's absolutely forbidden. Maybe it means if there's other alternatives. In this case, I mean, there's other ways of defeating the plishtim as well. You don't necessarily have to smoke them out by this way, but whatever. He figured this was the easiest way. Anyway. So that's the second. So far we have two explanations what his shaila was. One, that it was tamun, or two, that it was it allowed to burn these Jews' odim, their stacks of barley, in order to get rid of the plishtim. And then later. Explanation number three, but Rabbanon retained Rabbah Mori. Omir Rabbanon, or some say Rabbah Bar Mori, said a third explanation. Addition to Sa'urni Israel Habu, yes, there were stacks of grain, of barley, that belonged to Jews, but also addition to Adoshim to plishtim. There were also, in that area, there were piles of the stacks of lentils that belonged to plishtim. The common boiler, and therefore now the question was something else. Mao little gdishin shall sa'ur Yisrael litin lefenebehento, amanas l'shalom gdishin shall adoshim to plishtim. Are we allowed to now take these piles of grain, of barley that belong to the Jews, so that we have what to feed the animals with, the animals that we need for fighting the war? And then, on condition that once we defeat the plishtim and we have their stacks of lentils, we will reimburse them using the lentils. We'll reimburse the Jews whose barley has been confiscated using the lentils. So according to that, then, based in Beis Lechem, sent back to him as follows. The Pasuk says, the Pasuk in Yechezkel, Yechezkel lived a few hundred years later, but we often find the Gemara does that, quotes the Lashon HaPasuk, even though the actual Pasuk is from much later, because they knew the concept before that also. Tosfos mentioned it in Gittin, for example. Pasuk says, Chavol Yashiv, he returns what was damaged, Rosha Gzela Yishalim, the Rosha repays the Gzela, meaning, Afrishi Gzela Mishalim, Rosha. So even though he ends up paying what he stole, nevertheless, he's still called a Rosha because he shouldn't have stolen it in the first place. In other words, you're not allowed to steal Almanach, but you're going to pay back the person later. Aval, but again, they tell him, Ata Melech, Ata, you are a king, therefore an exception is made for you. You would be allowed to do that, because Bechlal, you wouldn't be obligated to reimburse the people. You Bechlal have eminent domain rights. The Rosh talks about that actually in this connection, that maybe if the Adoshim are available right away, then maybe there's not a Shaila. Adoshim are worth more, that lentils are worth more than barley. So if you have an immediate thing that you're able to exchange, you already have the lentils in your possession and you want to make an exchange, fine, then be no Shiloh. Of course you'd be allowed to. The question is, in this case, they hadn't yet captured the lentils. They knew that they're in the area. They knew once they defeat the Plishtim, they will have them. But they don't have them right now, so then the question is, can they do it later? Tosfos understands,
and the answer is,
well, that's the answer, is that you're not allowed to do that, that they're telling him normally you're not allowed to do that, but a king, there's an exception. Tosfos learns somewhat differently.
That's a king, but it's in the case of war.
That's what we're talking about, fine. So,
telling a king.
Okay, it doesn't matter. I mean, a king also, you know, also includes somebody who's, when you have, for example, like Moshe Rabbeinu had the din of a king, Yeshua had the din of a king, you know, when the Jewish people collectively are doing in a war or whatever, to a certain extent that has the din of a king as well. But whatever, the point is, even in peacetime, he has the ability to do what they're telling him. Tosfos, anyway, understands a little bit differently. That these Adoshim actually is, they originally belonged to the Plishtim, but by now, because the Plishtim were running away from the battlefield, or the local Plishti landowners, whatever, are running away, therefore these lentils ended up being Hefker, and Jews are being Zerser men. So the question basically is, the question that David is having is about exchanging the lentils for the barley, which would mean he'd end up taking from both parties. He'd end up taking the barley from the people who originally had the barley because he needed to feed his animals, and then he'd be taking the lentils from the people who had already been zochet and from after in order to repay the people for their barley. So he took barley. He'd be taking barley from Jews, and then he'd be taking lentils from Jews who had just been zeicher in it from Hefker, where these lentils previously belonged to Plishtim. So now let's analyze the psukim in terms of these three possibilities. Bishleim lamanda amalei chlupi. I can understand, according to the opinion, that the last opinion, that the question was about swapping out barley for lentils. Fine, and that explains why in Divrei Yomim it describes that it describes that the field was a field of lentils. And then in Divrei Yomim, when it tells the story again, it says that it was a field of barley, because then there's barley and there's lentils involved. If you're talking about that it was a case of burning it down, the case of Tamun, or that he wants to burn the stacks of barley in order to smoke out the Plishtim, then what do you need both to him? What is the one about lentils telling us anything more? Amalach, he can answer. We'd have an unexpedition to Adoshim be still that the time of Plishtim. Fine, there weren't just stacks of barley, there were also stacks of lentils that also the Hatchila belonged to Jews. Unlike the last opinion that the lentils belonged to the Plishtim, here, according to this opinion, the lentils also belonged to Jews. So you have the stacks of barley that Plishtim were hiding among. There were also stacks of lentils that the Plishtim were hiding among. And the question was about burning down both of them. And again, Marsha says the question of Tamun may have been a similar kind of thing also, that there were stacks of barley where only the outside of the stack was barley, but inside them, hidden inside them, is lentils. And then therefore you'd have the question again, if you burn down such a stack, are you chayiv only for the value of barley or are you chayiv for the value of lentils? Okay.
There's barley that belongs to Jews and lentils that belongs to Christian.
And the other is that both the barley and the Fine, let's continue. According to the opinion that says, the second opinion of Huna, who says the question was about burning down the stacks, Then we understand the pasuk continued. It's actually not really continued. The pasuk first starts by mentioning the story about the barley or the lentils in the two different places. Then, in the next psukim after that, it mentions the business about the water. So that's actually the Ravid points out that on the face of it, the pasuk seems to be presenting it as two separate stories. But he explains based on analyzing the psukim that the Gemara is assuming that it's one long story. Based on that how did it come about that they saved the barley or they saved the lentils? Because David had a shayla, and he wasn't sure what to do, and therefore they wound up breaking through the line in order to bring back the answer to the shayla. And based on that, Vayatzileho, they had previously saved the barley or the lentils. So if we say that it was a question of burning them down, okay, that's Vayatzileho. Then it means they saved it. They shouldn't be burnt. If you say that it was just a matter of swapping out barley for lentils, what's vayakileha? What saving is there involved? Then says leshalaklulachlofi that David is saying it's true. The Sanhedrin, the Beis Din of Beis Lechem, is saying that I have the right to do this. However, I'm not going to avail myself of that right. I'm not going to allow that, even though it's true, technically as a king, I would be allowed, melech peretz, lots of together, but I'm not going to do that, therefore I'm not going to allow you to swap them out. If we want to use this barley to feed our animals, we're going to have to buy it from the people rather than just taking it by eminent domain. And that Tosus points out here that's why the Pasuk mentions Vayatzileho in the case of both, in the case of the barley and in the case of the lentils, because both of them were saved for their respective owners. Again, according to this opinion, both the barley and the lentils at this point belong to Jews. The barley originally belonged to them. Lentils, Jews had taken from Hefker, from the Plishtim who ran away. Therefore, he's saving both crops. The barley is still being kept by its owners, and if they want to feed the animals, they have to pay them for it. And the lentils are remaining with their owners, with whoever was there, saying it's from Hefker, and he's not taking it away from them to pay for the barley. Fine, let's continue analyzing. I can understand, according to both of those opinions, that it was a matter of burning the crops, or that it was a matter of exchanging the crops. Okay, well, that's why you have two psukim, one that mentions barley, one that mentions lentils, because there were both barley and lentils involved, as we said. But if you say it was a matter of tamun mai boile kroy, then what do you need these psukim? So Rashi has a girsa. Well, so Rashi has a girsa kroy lomali, which basically amounts to why do you need either pasuk? Maybe not. I mean, if you're saying that it's a matter of tamun, you don't really need. If you're saying it's a matter of tamun, then okay. According to Marsha's explanation, that lentils inside barley, then yes. But other than that, though, on the face of it, tamun doesn't necessarily have to do with either lentils or barley. Tosfos mentions a different girsa, which is that I can understand why you need one or the other of the psukim. Okay, among the barley in the stacks of barley that were hidden kalim, or in the stacks of lentils that were hidden kalim. But you don't need two separate psukim to tell us there were two different kinds of crops that are involved over here. The answer is so the Omalach. So that opinion of Nachman will answer you. Tomun v'chodem mehana chamabayla. Actually, what David has is two shilas. One of his shilas was the matter of tomun, and then aside from that, he had one of the other two shilas as well. The shila wasn't only on tomun. Fine, it was tomun plus either of these other questions about burning down the stacks to smoke out the plishtim, or exchanging one set of stacks for the other. So then, that's why I need two psukim. Bishlan and Mandra Mahani Taiti, fine, according to the opinion that it was one or the other of those questions about burning them down or about exchanging them. Then we can understand why the pasuk continues. The pasuk continues that David didn't want to drink the water, which would mean, in terms of how we're explaining that the water means a psak in halacha, it means he didn't want to accept that psak. He didn't want to follow it. Because, Omar, because the psak that says that as a king, he's entitled to do it, to burn them or to exchange them. So if you say, if you say according to the second or third explanations that they're telling him, really, usually this would be something that's also, but because you're a king, an exception is going to be made. Fine, David has the ability to say, fine, but I don't want to avail myself of that exception.
So what did he ask in the first place? He knew he didn't want to avail himself.
Because he wanted to know whether it's actually allowed or Allah. Once they told him that usually it's also up the Allah, but in this case there's an exception, that's different. So therefore, since after all, usually there would be an issur involved, fine, I could get away with it because I'm a king. I don't want to do that. I don't want to use that tape. Meaning if they had said that Lachila, you're allowed to do such a thing, anybody's allowed to do such a thing, then he would have done it. Yeah. But if you say it's a question of Tomun, again, like Rashi said, his men destroyed some sacks of grain, and the question was about paying for it. And Mechti Gemoru Deshachalei, okay, what they sent him is an actual halacha. Whatever they sent him, whether they hold like Rabbi Huda or the Chachamim, either way, it's not a question of that normally it would be author, but you, for you, it's Mutter or anything like that. They're telling him a straight out halacha. My love, other David Leshtoisem. So what do you mean he didn't want to drink it? What, does he not want to accept the halacha? What does that mean? Now, Tosva says, the Gemara could have answered, again, the Gemara could have answered a minute ago, that he had a question that we just said, that Rav Nachman, who says that he was asking about Tomun, agrees that he also had one of the other Shilohs. So fine, about that Shiloh could say, below Abadav the Shtoysen. But Tosva says, the Lashon of the Pasuk is Mashma, that everything that he asked about, he didn't want to accept. So he had to, according to that way of looking at it, he had two Shilohs. But that he didn't want to accept their answer for either one of them. Now, why not? For Tomun, what they're to not accept. So, the answer is, Deloy Amrinu Mishmai. It means something different. It doesn't mean he didn't accept the halacha. It means he didn't say over this halacha afterwards in the name of these Giborim, these three Giborim who broke through the lines to bring back the Pesachdin. Why? Omar, because he said, see, I have the Kabbalah from the base din of Shmuel HaRamasi, Shmuel HaNavi, that Kalam Moister Atmed Lomus Al Divrei Torah, anybody who's Moister himself, anybody who gives himself over to die for Divrei Torah, Ein Omim Dvar Halacha Mishma. You do not say a word of Halacha over in his name. So why not? So in other words, he's saying, since you risked your life to bring back this halacha, and this was an inappropriate thing to do, then you shouldn't have the halacha set in. So that's the thing. So Marsha and a number of other Meforshim say that what he's saying is, it's in a negative sense. He's saying, the fact is, you're not supposed to be most of nefesh for such a thing. What you did is inappropriate. Therefore, you don't deserve that the halacha should be said. That the halacha should be said in your name. Marsha says, for example, we know the famous thing: "Kol Omer Davar B'Shem Omer, maybe go all along." Look, careful of us. But somebody who acts inappropriate like that doesn't deserve that through him there should be brought Geula to the world. That's the point. Because he risked his life. Because of a high ban below Shem span. There is a chassidish of art on it that I've seen it brought in the name of Rav Simcha Bonim of Shitzchah and in the name of Kedusha Harim, and I don't remember who else. Tzadik Akoyim says something similar. That's Fakir, to Lamal Yusa. A person who goes on the Siddur Nefesh like that, it's like he's on such a high level, it doesn't even need to be said in his name anymore. It's like he's at that point, he's like one with the Eidrishter, so to speak, and therefore it doesn't even need to be said in his individual name anymore. Incidentally, you can ask the obvious question. What about Rabbi Akiva? What about Rabbi Akiva, for example, was Moshe Nefesh?
Yeah,
two answers for that. One is the difference between Talmud Torah Derabim and not. In Rabbi Akiva's case, he's teaching Torah in public. Chinuch Mitzvah also is teaching Torah in public, etc. It's different over here, where it's psacked in for a private person. That's one. And then the other possibility is actually, at least as far as Rabbi Akiva, there are people, Doris of Shonim, for example, has a long discussion of it, that when Rabbi Akiva was doing all that, teaching Torah in public, the problem wasn't that he might be killed. The problem was that just that he might be arrested. But fine, that's not such a matter of Mesidus Nefesh. But it doesn't answer the question as far as, for example, of Hanani Mitzvah, who knew that he's risking his life, but at least it answers as far as Rabbi Akiva. As far as Rav Hananim and Chad, then maybe Yitzhak have to answer that there's a difference in Talmud Torah Derabim and not. Anyway.
From the last minute, you're not allowed.
So, the, yeah. Okay. Yeah. They're moist and nefesh they're moist and nefesh to live as yidden. We're talking about to just be moist and nefesh to go from point A to point B to bring back a word of Torah or whatever. Don't do that. Besides, okay, you know what? So fine. These chassidim weren't concerned about whether you're going to say it by halacha in their name, you know. Okay. So the pasuk continues by Yachtech Oisim Hashem. The pasuk continues that he poured out this water for Hashem. So again, in terms of what we're talking about, that the water means Torah, it would have to mean something about. It would have to mean that he did something with something about the halacha. So Bishleim Lamando Amahani Tauti. So according to the second and third opinion, it means Mishum Da Avod L'Shem Shemayim. Means by Yachta Chosin L'Hashem means he sort of poured it out in the sense he said, even though there is a heter for me as a king, but I'm not going to use that heter. I don't want to rely on a terim. I'll pour it out to Hashem, meaning for the sake of Hashem L'Shem Shemayim, because the usual halacha is that you're not allowed to, then I'm not going to. El Lamandam Tomun Ba'ish, but if you're going to say his problem, his question was Tomun Ba'ish, my Vayasachosim Hashem, then what is Vayasachosim Hashem? So, okay, Veloyav Adobe the Shtoisa means he didn't want to say it over in their name. What's Vayasachosim Hashem? It means Damruna Mishma de Gemara. It means he said over this teaching instead of saying it over in the name of the three Giborim that they said it in the name of the Beis Din of Beis Lechem, he just said Mishma de Gemara anonymously, like all the Chachamim together. Like the Chachamim of the Bais Medrash said such and such. That's the point. In other words, according to Marsha and Maral and so forth, that it was inappropriate for them to do this. Then that's what he means. Because you did something inappropriate, therefore you don't get the schus. To break through and be moitzeh nefesh to bring back the tzak halacha. Therefore, instead of it being said over in your name, it'll be said over Mishma de Gemara anonymously. Again, according to Chassidus Shavuot, then it's the other way around. That the Hakeh, you know, now, so to speak, you belong to the Eivishter. You're Echa Be'Echa with the Eivishter, and therefore it'll be said Mishma de Gemara, where you know, in Leila Kadosh Baruch Hu Ba'olam Ela Dalad Am Shalom.
This Gemara is anything but anonymous.
No, but we're talking about the Gemara. Mishnah says, "Over the Geder Shul Gevoya Dalad Am, if the fire crosses a fence," and geder in Gemara terminology usually means a stone fence. A stone is fireproof. So if it crosses the fence, which is 4 amos high, a derech harabim, or a public road, which is 16 amos wide, a nahar, or a river, potter, then the person who lit the fire is potter, because you don't expect it to spread like that. Well, not so obvious. First of all, what do we mean by 4 amos? So let's learn the Gemara, and then we'll also talk about what Tosfos said about it. First of all, Vatanya over Gedesh or Gavoya Abamas Chayev, what are you talking about? The Mishnah says that if it got across a wall that's 4 amos high, then you're potter, but the Braisa says you're Chayev. So what is it? Amar Papa, Tani Didan Kachoshim Milamayra Lamata. The difference is the Tana of our Mishnah is going from above to below. Namely, he's saying like this, Sheish Amos Potter, if the wall was 6 Amos tall, then you're Potter. Chomish Amos, then you're also Potter. Ad Arba Amos Potter, up until you reach the 4 Amos limit, you're still Potter. If it's anything lower than 4 Amos, then you'll be Chayav. Tana Bottom, Milmat Lamayla Kachosha, whereas the Tana of the Bright is going the other way around, from below to above. Shtei Amos Chayav, Sholosh Amos Chayav, Ad Arba Amos, up until, meaning with anything less than 4 Amos, you're Chayav. Once you reach 4 Amos, you're Potter. So in other words, they're both agreeing, they're just putting it in different terms. But the Shitim Kubetis has a different explanation. He says that they may be arguing, does it have to be exactly 4 amos, or can it be, or does it have to be, is it enough if it's exactly 4 amos, or does it have to be a little bit more than 4 amos in order to be possible? Amar Rava, Dalad Amos Sh'amur Jepotter, when we say 4 amos Jepotter, Afilu Bisdei Koitin. This means even if it's a field full of thorns, it means that from the top of a thorn upward, there has to, you know, not the total height of the fence is 4 amos. It means that from the upper edge of the koitim is 4 amos. So what are we talking about over here? In other words, the koitim, let's say, are 2 amos tall. So you need the whole wall needs to be 6 amos tall. Now, a number of interesting things about this. First of all, Tosfos argues that on the contrary, the question is not so much. I mean, we would think we're talking about how much higher is the wall than the fire. Tosfos says on the face of it, why? You don't need to fall 4 amos above the top edge of the fire, unless, as the Gemara is going to talk about in a minute, fire is a horizontal one. That's different. But if it's whether it's a horizontal or a vertical fire, either way, if you have a stone wall which is anything higher than the fire, then it'll prevent it from spreading. Well, what kind of 4 amos is it? So Tosfos talks about that the 4 amos that we're talking about is actually you don't consider the height of the flame, rather you consider the height of the kindling. The kindling, now there's two different types of kindling that we can be dealing with over here. There's the pile of wood where presumably, how did the fire start? The pastures, you were lighting a fire in your resource and it spread. The pastures, you have wood over there set up for a bonfire or whatever. And then you have the toitzim, you have the thorns. Different Rishonim talk about the different possibilities. When the Gemara mentions over here, they toitzim, Tosfos also is discussing it. Are we talking about that the thorns are on the same side of the fire? Or are we talking about where they're on the other side of the fence than the fire? That also affects how we learn the Gemara over here with Sfas Kotzim Olamayla. Tosfos, for example, gives a couple of different explanations over here. One of them is that the Mishnah is talking about, but if you have a pile of wood on one side of the fence where you're lighting a fire, you have to make sure that fence, that stone wall, is at least 4 amos above the top end of the wood. And then the Papa is coming and adding, in addition, you also need to have, if there's thorns on the other side of the fence, let's say, you also need to have that the wall extends 4 amos above the top edge of those. No, it's still 4 amos, but in other words, if the stack of wood is 3 amos tall, let's say, and the coatium are 4 amos tall, then you're going to need a wall which is total 8 amos tall. So it's 5 amos higher than the stack of wood and 4 amos higher than the coat. It needs to be at least four amos higher than either one of the things that are flammable. Once you do that, if then when you light this 3 amos stack of wood on fire and the flames extend upwards 6 amos, so the flames are higher than the wall, doesn't matter. Again, there's different other Rishonim talk about different other possibilities. One interesting one that I've heard says that actually that it's not a fibu b'sdei kotzim, it's rather b'sdei kotzim. When you have a field of thorns, then you need a 4 amah height above the top of the thorns, because the Ravid says thorns, how when you light something lightweight like that in a bonfire, little sparks and things are always shooting off of it, and therefore they can easily start fires. As opposed to if you're burning something more solid like wood, then you don't need as much as 4 amahs. Then even less than 4 amahs is good enough. Amar Rav, lo shanu ela b'kelachas. That's right. Amar Rav, lo shanu ela b'kelachas. This that we're talking about, so that if it crossed a wall or road, etc., then you potter, is only if it's a vertical fire. Kelachas is more like kelach, like a stalk of grain. So it's a fire that goes straight up. Aval b'nichfetes, but if it's a fire that's bending downward, which means the Rashi gives two explanations. One is that it means, like you said, that there's a wind and the wind is bending it downward. So then it's more likely to jump from one point to another. It can spread very easily. And then Rashi says the second explanation is nichfetes is sometimes you have like there's a vertical fire and then you have like a brush fire that's creeping along the ground and going and finding more and more fuel as it goes along. The Rambam gives a third explanation, by the way. The Rambam says that nichfetes means a fire that's so large that the tips of the flames are already starting to bend downward. So then again, you can have that, it can easily, a bit of it can easily detach and set something else on fire. So then, afilad mea am chayev. Then you chayev even a hundred amos. So what do we mean? So what do we mean 100 amos? So Tosfos discusses. We don't mean that if there was a wall there 100 amos tall, you'd be chayev. We mean as far as width. That if it crossed 100 amos width, 100 amos away, you'd still be chayev. Yeah. Tosfos says the other way around, rather, Tosfos brings both possibilities. Tosfos mentions there's two different girsahs. One is mea ama and the other is mea mil. If the girsah is mea ama, like we have over here in the Gemara, And soon we're going to have Mea Mil and a Braisa. If you say Mea Amah, Tosfos says, then it's referring to the height of the gedder that's involved over here. That even it's true, you have a very tall gedder over there, a very tall stone fence. But because the fire is misstepped, it's creeping along the ground, therefore you're going to be high regardless. Later, maybe because it would go under the woman, it would go around it. I don't know. So then you'd be chayev because then that such a fire is likely to spread no matter what. Shmuel says, on the contrary, the Mishnah is talking about a creeping fire or a low or whatever fire that's bent down low. But on the contrary, if it's a vertical fire, I feel like kosher butter. You don't even need any amount, even a small amount of distance, your potter. In other words, when the Mishnah said, for example, if it crossed the Derech HaRabim, a 16-amel wide road, your potter, Shmuel would say, if it was a vertical fire, you don't even need 16 amos. It's not going to spread even less than 16 amos if it's vertical and there's no wind. Tanya Kava says Rav, we learn a Braisa in accordance with Rav. When are we talking about these measurements that it says in the Mishnah? When it's a vertical fire, Av Menechpefes, but if it's a horizontal fire, the Eitzim Mitzurin Law, and there is wood available to it, Afila, Mea Mil Chayev, and even 100 Mil Yuchayev. And here's where Tosfos says that Mea Mil means horizontally. You know, even if the fire ends up spreading 100 mil away from where it originally started, you're still going to be higher because it was creeping fire and therefore it's likely to continue spreading. Continues the Braisa. Over a nahar, a shlulis, shem rechavim ketamis, but if the fire crosses a river or a shlulis, we'll define soon what a shlulis is. In modern Hebrew, shlulis means a puddle, but the Gemara is going to say soon that's not what it means. Which are at least 8 amos wide, then you're potter. Apparently, it's not a contradiction. It means that if it's dry land, then if it's a horizontal fire, it's still going to be able to spread. But if there's water in between, if there's an 8 amos body of water in between, that's going to be enough to stop even an Estefes fire. And therefore, you'll be potter for that.
So previously,
we were talking about whether this is dry land. Yeah. So actually, not all the Rishonim, the Rif, for example, does not bring all of these particular details that we're learning here, that we're going to learn on Amud Beis, because the Rambam does. So evidently, the Rambam holds that at least some of these distinctions that the Gemara is making over here have validity, and he holds like Rav. But the Rif, for example, doesn't bring them, because the Mephoshim said, because evidently the Rif says that ultimately all you have to do is it's not something that you can give general rules for. It's a case-by-case basis. In each individual case, you'd have to figure out what kind of fire it was, what were the wind conditions, what were the local ground conditions, etc., and then decide on that basis. The Mishnah said Derech HaRabim, that if it crosses a Derech HaRabim, a public road, then you're potter. Man Tana, who is the Tana who said that? Amar Rabba, Rabbi Eliezer. So Rabbi says that would be Rabbi Eliezer. It's not, as we learn in the Mishnah, on Amud Beis, Rabbi Eliezer, and the Shesh Esher Amat Zedech Rosh Hashanah, and Potter. Okay, so Tosfos says in that case, then what's the Chiddush? The Chiddush is that Rabbi wants us to know that this is one of those cases where you have a Sam Mishnah, and afterwards you have a Machlotus on that same topic. Because we're going to have on Amud Beis, Rabbi Eliezer saying that. The implication is, therefore, that Halacha is not like that. That's the rule. When you have a Sam Mishnah and then a Machlotus, then the Halacha is not like the Sam Mishnah. So therefore, the Tosfos understands that means to say the halacha is not like Rabbi Eliezer, therefore. So then it would be, there are other Mephoshim, who learn differently, who say that actually the next Mishnah just says, the next Mishnah just mentions Tet Dynamis Kedera Fish Rabbim, but doesn't use the word Potter. What we're quoting over here that says Potter may actually be a Braisa, and in that case, Rava is not trying to tell us about the Chachamim versus Rebbe Eliezer. He may be saying, our Mishnah is appointed to Rebbe Eliezer. The next Mishnah is also appointed to him, but you should know that you should know the Braisa is clarifying that when he says in the next Mishnah that Derech HaRabim Tet Dynama, he means to say that if it crossed that amount of distance, then you're Potter. The Mishnah said, "Oy nahar, that if it crossed a river, you're potter." What do we mean by a river? Rav am a nahar mamish. Rav says it means literally a river. Or Shmuel am a arisa de daloi. Shmuel says it doesn't even have to be a river. It can be a canal that they use for watering the fields. which we learned, actually. We learned the other day. We had the case of an animal that fell into such a canal. We said typically it's one amma wide and one amma deep. So, mandom and noha mamash would say apagata like a maya. The opinion that says, Rabu says that it means really a river, an actual river. It means even if right now there's no water in it, you're still potter because it's wide. It's wide enough that it serves as a fire break. Tosfos says, so why is it by a derech harabim we say 16 amos and you 8 amos is enough? And the reason is, Tosfos says, because it's deep, and also because the fact is, water usually flows in it, so therefore it's cooler, it's not as flammable as like a dry, dusty road that is likely to be, where it's likely to be flammable stuff. Therefore, you're possible. So I mean, even if there's no water, or Mandama Arisa Didloy, where Shmuel says that it means a canal, only Ispe Maya. That would only work. You'd only be potter if there's water in it. But if there's no water in it, then you would be chayv across it, because there's a one amma wide Arisa without water is not going to be an effective fireplace. So now we mentioned. And it usually be said it's one amma. Now, we mentioned before, in the Braisa, we mentioned the word shlulis. So now the Gemara is going to bring in a Mishnah from Peya in order to define for us what the word shlulis means. Tanan Hasan, we learned a Mishnah in Masechta Peya. The Elam Apsik in the Peya. The following things are a break as far as Peya. We know the Torah says, Pas Sadcha, that you're supposed to leave the corner of your field for the poor people. That means each individual field you have to leave pay from. So the question is, what for this purpose is considered an individual field? What's if you have one big area that you cultivate, but there's a separation of some kind in the middle of it, what kind of separation makes it into two separate fields? And then you have to repay any, then you have to leave pay at each one, right? So the Elam of Stick and the Peah, the following things are considered a separation as far as Peah. Hanachal, a stream, Vashlulis, or Shlulis, which we're going to define soon, the Derech HaYochad, the Derech HaRabim, or private road, which Rashi says is 4 amas wide, or Derech HaRabim, a public road, which we said is 16 amas wide. My choice discusses why it needs to mention both, but because when it comes to Peah, you would think maybe a small road is not enough, perhaps it.
Derech HaRabim is...
It's 16.
Defined by the length.
No, by the width. By the width.
By the width. Not by the number of people.
Yeah. There's Rishus Adam and there's Derech Adam, two different things. Okay. Question is, my shlulis. What does the word shlulis mean? Amr of Yehuda Amashmul, Mokam Shemeg Shalom Sholim Shom. It means a place where rainwater collects. Rashi gives two explanations how Sholim comes to mean collect. One is it's Meloshin Sholol Shobetim, like a cluster of eggs. And the other one is Meloshin Sholol Amakayah. In this week's parasha, that means like the booty, the spoils that you collect from war. Therefore, the pond, like where water collects. I guess this is where in modern Hebrew they got the idea to use the word shlulit to mean a puddle, because that's basically what a puddle is. But here we're talking about a rather large one, because it has to be 8. We said it has to be 8 amas wide. Rabbi Amar Rabbi Yehonan says a different explanation. It means amas hamayim shemachalekas sholol lagapeha. It means it's a water canal that gives out shalol to its banks. Meaning, in other words, that Rashi says they use it to draw water from it, and they use it to water the fields on either side, and therefore they produce shalol. They produce fruit.
An irrigation
channel. Yeah. Tosfos says something somewhat different. So that it means that it's a canal where they dig little channels off of it, so that when it gets full, then it overflows into those channels and fills up the local water holes and wells and cisterns and things like that. Anyway, so mandom amakom shemeg sham shalom sham kol shkenam samay. The Rabbi Yehuda Amashmul, who says that a shlulis means a pond, would say how much more so an amas hamayim, how much more so a canal would be enough to be considered a hefsek as far as payah. Well, Mandram amas hamayim, there is the opinion who says that if it means a canal for irrigation, he would say avamokum shmeik sham shalom sham loybas. He would say, but no, but a pond where water collects is not considered a hefsek as far as payah. The hanu bogni de ara mikru, because that kind of thing is just called like the basins, the low down places in the ground. It's not really considered an entity of its own. The first talk about, the Gemara is mentioning it in connection with Teya, what about would the same machlokas apply as far as a fire or not, which after all is the subject of our mission. A different day on that.
And the
halacha, I'm not sure. Mishnah says, if somebody lights a fire in his own domain, how far do we consider that the fire is going to spread? That, in other words, we make him chayev up to that point. What we do is we picture it as if it was in the middle of a base kur. A base kur is an area where you can plant one kur of wheat or barley. A kur is 30 sa in modern terms of 500 pounds. A base kur is defined as an area 75,000 square hours. So if you make a square out of it, it comes out about 274 amos to a side, 400 feet, give or take. A square 400 feet, give or take, on a side. So therefore, in other words, what you do is, if there's at least a half of a base course, so 200 feet approximately, in each direction from it, then you potter, and if it ends up spreading, then you can't be held at fault for that. That's considered annoying. Again, Rashi points out, based on what we learned on Amud Aleph, this has to be talking about a vertical fire. So with a horizontal fire, we already said on Amud Aleph, that coins are nav, there's no limit for it. Rabbi Eliezer says 16 amos, the same as the width of the Rishos Rabim, as long as you have 16 amos, there's a clear space around it. Rabbi Shimon says, well, the pasuk says shalom yishalom amaver tabeira. The pasuk says the one who lit the fire is chayav. Meaning hakol l'fiyad leita. It all depends on the fire. What that means exactly, we'll see. I mean, on the face of it, it sounds like no matter what, you're always going to have to pay because the fact is the fire spread. But we'll discuss in the morning what exactly it means. Okay. So that's the question. The less layer of Shimon Shiura Bitlaika. What does Rav Shimon not hold that there is a limitation as far as fire, that there is a certain expected area that fire is expected to spread, and beyond that you falter? Because that's on the face of it. Hakol Fiat Laika sounds like he's saying, no matter how far the fire burns, you're gonna be tired. How can that be? Well, Tanan, we learn in a Mishnah in Baba Basra. Lo Yamid Adam Tanur Basechabai, if a person is not allowed to set up an oven in his house. Unless the ceiling is at least 4 amos above the top of the oven. Ovens, remember, in those days, the fire was at the bottom. They were shaped kind of like an upside-down cup with the top and bottom missing. So, you know, you'd have the fire down here and the heat would rise up. So too close to the ceiling, it'll set the ceiling on fire. So Rashi explains, we're not talking about over here, we're not even talking about the neighbors, we're talking about the people of the city have the right to prevent him from putting in an oven unless there's at least 4 amos above it, because then if he sets his own house on fire, he'll end up burning down the whole town. Tosfos discusses that it may have another meaning as well. It means if you have, for example, a two-story house, where one person owns the ground floor and the other one, another person, owns the top floor, the person on the top floor can say you're not allowed to put an oven in your apartment, on your ground floor apartment, unless there's at least 4 amos of space above it so you don't set your ceiling, which is my floor, on fire.
Amazing that we're authorizing even for 4 amos or beyond.
So 4 amos is considered enough, so that's the thing.
It's not safe.
That's the thing. We're not... 4 amos means, in other words, the oven itself, let's say, is 5 amos tall. Yeah. So an additional 4 amos, you need a total of 9 amos. 5 amos for the height of the oven itself, plus another 4 amos. That's enough room for the heat to dissipate. Remember, the fire is at the bottom of the oven. You know, it's not all the way up the side. Anyway, this is the amount the Chachamim figured out that should be enough. And the Mishnah continues, what about the other way around? If you're putting the oven on the second floor, what are the rules? Then the rule is you need to have at least 3 tfachim thick plaster underneath it. Maziva is a plaster that you put over the beams, over the ceiling beams. You need at least 3 tfachim thick of plaster, again, underneath it, again, so it doesn't burn through. Over kira tefach, if it's not an oven, but rather a kira, which is a stove, You don't light such a large fire in it. If you do it in an oven, then all you need is one. And the Mishnah continues, the imhizik, if after all he did cause damage, so he did end up setting the ceiling or the roof or whatever on fire, mashallah mashhizik, and he still has to pay for whatever he was mapping. And if it's fine, he followed the rule. Nevertheless, though, there still caused the fire, he's still going to be chayim. Rib Shimon says, no, loy nemer, shurim alolo, ala shem hizik, fasim l'shalim. No, on the contrary, he says, the whole point of these shurim is that if you cause hezik, you're going to be potter from pain. And the Hakam is saying, these shurim are meant for, if you don't have the four amos, let's say, for example, then the people can prevent you from putting the oven in at all. If you put in the oven, though, and it caused the fire, you're still going to be chayim. Rib Shimon is saying, no, it's both. With less than four amos, you're not allowed to put it in. Once you have four amos, though, A, you can put it in, and B, you're not chayim. So at that point, you did what you're supposed to. So we see that Shimon holds that there is a limitation, that there's a certain amount. Once there's four amos or three tefachim or what have you, the various measurements that we just said, then we assume that's enough for it to be fireproof, and therefore if the fire spreads, then you're not hired. So what is he telling us in our Mishnah that no matter how far the fire spread, you're hired? Amr Rav Nachman, Amr Rav Avora. What it means is that kol lefi goyva hadleika. No, what Rav Shimon means in our Mishnah is it all depends on the height of the fire. Because the higher the fire, the bigger the fire, the more likely it is to jump around and spread. So it doesn't mean, in other words, Rav Shimon is not saying regardless of how far it grows to the size. He's saying you can't give a fixed amount, like you say, in the middle of a base core or 16 amos or 50 amos or whatever. You have to look what kind of fire was it. Obviously, you're going to have Adim. There always has to be Adim for these kinds of things. You have Adim who testify what the size of the fire was, and based on that, you can evaluate, is that something that was likely to spread or not under normal circumstances. Okay. Amar Rabbi Yosef, Amar Rabbi Yehuda, Amar Shmuel, Halacha Kerub Shimon, V'chein Amar Rabbi Nachman, Amar Shmuel, Halacha Kerub Shimon. Halacha is like it. Mishnah says, "Hamadlik of a goddish, if somebody ignites a stack of grain that belongs to somebody else, v'hoyev a kalim v'doku, and there were kalim inside it, there were vessels or tools inside it, and they got burnt." Rabbi Yehuda and Mishalim Mashal says, "Rabbi Yehuda says you have to pay for whatever was inside it, inside the goddish." V'chomem and Mishalim el goddish shochit narshel sarim. Some say no, you just pay the value of a stack of wheat or barley. Meaning, in other words, basically, as Gemara, we'll talk about that. It means you figure out how much volume was occupied by those kalim. You imagine as though that volume was filled up with wheat or barley or what have you. Instead, you just pay according to that. That's the point. The Rabbi Yehuda holds you chayev on tamun and the chamol your budget. That's exactly the point. When we mentioned the story of David, that Rabbi Yehuda, and previously we talked about the Chachamim and Rabbi Yehuda argue on this matter of Tamun, this is where we get it from. Thing is the Mishnah. Hoyog di kofus, we learned about this earlier in the Masechta. Hoyog di kofus loy v'eved samach loy. If you had a goat tied to the stack of grain, or you had an eved standing next to it, v'nistrach v'zmei, and they were burnt together with the goddish, chayev. Then you're chayev because you're chayev for the goat because you call hezek. Actually, we learned before. Rashi had mentioned the concept that it means even if the we'll talk about that with the next piece actually. But the point is that you're chayev for the goat because as we learned before, oy hakoma, you're chayev for anything that has a height to it, anything that stands independently. You potter for the eved because the eved could have run away. It was tied to it, he said. Wait. What about Eved Kofuslay of Disamaflay? What about though the other way around? If you had an Eved tied to the stack of grain, or you had a goat next to it, the Nisra remained and was grown together with him, Potter. Then he's Potter because Kom Lebed did out, as we've learned before. Now, okay, so because Kom Lebed did out, because he's high of Nisra for the Eved. Because therefore you can, and that's the point. Rashi says actually the point. Rashi earlier when we learned this in the Masechta, Rashi pointed out the chiddush of it is that we say he's potter for the gdi. Even let's say the stack of grain belonged to one person and the gdi belonged to a different person, we still say he's potter for both. The fact that there's kamalim and the dinavimene potters him from paying either one of them. Here also Rashi points out something else, which is really Rashi gives two explanations. One is that with the goat, it doesn't really matter whether the goat was tied up or not. regardless, you're going to be potter for the goat. In other words, even if there was no eved involved over here, if you had a goat just standing next to the goddish, one explanation is you would in fact be potter because it should have run away. The other explanation is no. In that case, the tackle would be chayav. You're only potter again because there's an eved involved and therefore come limited out. So there's two different explanations that Rashi has whether you would be chayav for freestanding the deed. He's an eved tanami. You're still chayav for killing him. Misa. So if there was Eidim v'hasra, obviously you're going to be literally chayav misa. Even if there was no Eidim v'hasra, still, it means, as we learned before, tanim v'chizkiya, that kum l'vididavim, and it applies as long as you did an action which could have resulted in a chayav misa, even though in this particular case it doesn't, because there's no Eidim v'hasra, or shogig, or what have you, nevertheless, kum l'vididavim, and it still fixed it.
So chayav v'dishamayim, in that case?
Probably, but you're not chayav v'dishamayim anyway. By the way, there are all points out an interesting thing. Why Ephesus are we bringing in this din in connection with Tamun? He says, because imagine you have, for example, you went and ignited the goddish on this side. There was a goat or what have you on the other side where you didn't realize. You'd think maybe your potter at Tamun. No. Tamun is only inside the stack, not if it's next to it, but out of sight. Then is the Mishnah. Umoidim Chachamim L'Rabbi Yehuda B'Matzah K'Sabira. The Chachamim do agree with Rabbi Yehuda if somebody sets a bira, a building, on fire. Shum Shalom Kol Mashav Asofa. Then he has to pay everything. Then he has to pay for everything that was inside. Shekein Derech Ne'adam L'Aniach B'Batim. It's normal for people to leave things inside their houses. So therefore, you can't really call that Tumah. Tosfos discusses a little bit, and then we'll learn more of it in the Gemara at this point, probably tomorrow. That within the Goddish itself, there is going to be a difference. Even Rabbi Huda may agree that there's a difference between things that are normally placed inside a Goddish and not. What kind of things are normally placed inside a Goddish? Farm tools, let's say, as opposed to, for example, if a person claims that he had a money bag hidden inside there, that might be different. Well, we'll talk about it tomorrow in more detail. But then also there's a bit of discussion that the Gemara is going to discuss further the question, is there a difference in all of this regard? Is there a difference in all of this regard whether you lit the fire in your reshus and it just spread, or is it that you actually lit it to begin with in the other guy's reshus? Well, that's, again, when the Chachamim are saying you potter for tamun, is that in both cases, or is it only if you lit it in your reshus and then it spread?
Right.
We'll talk about it tomorrow.
In anybody's pursuit, you had a fire. Tamun doesn't.
But nevertheless, if the Torah is telling us, oh, you have comma, you learn from that, but you fought for Tamun, maybe. Okay, so we'll talk about it tomorrow.